Welcome to the Scientist Podcast, where we bring you the research community like you've never heard it before. Today on episode 13, we are joined by a Nobel Prize winner for chemistry. Joachim Frank will be taking us through his journey to becoming the esteemed scientist he is today, including how his interest sparked, how we work to solve the big gap in molecular imaging, and what he has done since receiving his Nobel Prize. If you enjoy this podcast and want to hear more from us, you can head to www.scientist.net/pages/podcast or search The Scientist Podcast on all major podcast apps. Hi everyone and welcome back to The Scientist Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on what is going to be a very exciting episode. Today we are privileged to not only be joined by an esteemed scientist but in fact a Nobel Prize winner. Without further ado, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Joachim Frank. I'm a professor at Columbia University, and I'm working in cryo-electron microscopy, and that's the area where I got my Nobel Prize in chemistry in. And I've been working on this technology for quite some time, since the 70s, in fact. And I didn't just work on the methodology, but I applied it specifically to look at the structural basis of translation of how the ribosome works.
Before we sort of delve deeper into what you won your Nobel Prize for, let's start at the beginning. What was it that initially interested you in science?
Well, it's a funny story because I already did science when I was 8 years old, without knowing that it was science. I had a natural curiosity and I did all kinds of things of mixing and looking at it. And I collected bottles and filled them with liquids and chemicals and so forth and, started reactions. So it's really, it was sort of a very natural interest that gradually became a more mainstream interest in science and especially physics when I got into high school.
And when you got into high school, was there sort of, do you have sort of a clear vision of where your career was going and where you wanted to go? Or did you just take
it? I only knew that that among all the areas in natural science, I would be interested in physics. So I elected advanced courses in physics, and I was always I always excelled in physics. It was sort of an intuitive kind of way. How I really jived with that kind of subject.
So did you sort of followed your heart and just and ended up doing sort of a PhD, master's sort of?
There was a major obstacle because my father, who was sort of very old school, he had big question whether physics would be earning any bread.
Really?
He thought of physics as something very esoteric, and so I had to convince him that in fact there was a future in it.
How do you think you won him over in the end?
Oh yeah, it was specifically he through a friend he found someone who was a physicist and who lived 20 miles away. So we took the train there and set up an appointment to talk with him in his living room. And then, a very embarrassing situation for me because I sat there and they talked about my future. That conversation convinced him that indeed there was something
that you were allowed to do it. And look at you now. Yeah. So you went to university to study physics, and then sort of did you find these interests as you went along?
Yeah, it's really you know, I didn't have any a clear vision when I finished my bachelor in science and at Freiburg University, and then you know I got into some kind of a master's program that I didn't know what I was getting into, and it just happened to involve electrons, but backscattering of electrons. So I, you know, built an experimental apparatus, and but my mentor happened to be someone, an old timer in electron microscopy, even though at the time that I took my master with him, he didn't do electron microscopy. But at any rate, he had a very old electron microscope in his office, an ancient one. And so we had some conversations about it. And so that's really how I got an interest in electron microscopy. And then when I tried to get them a place where to do my PhD, I restricted my search to Munich because I wanted to stay in Munich. And so that's how I found my mentor, who happened to be Walter Hoppe, and former X-ray crystallographer who had switched fields into electron microscopy. And so that's how I wound up in an environment with a lot of sophistication, a lot of theoretical sophistication. And so there were all kinds of ideas floating around that were incubated from X-ray crystallography, essentially. And so that's the environment that I was.
And was it when you did your PhD, is that sort of when the work that you eventually got awarded your Nobel Prize for, was that when that started, or did you do your PhD and then start to work on it?
Well, I started in image processing. That was the idea that I would develop programs for 3D reconstruction in electron microscopy, but that didn't exist as an area, really. There was nothing there. In the mindset of my mentor, all I had to do was somehow, you know, modify the programs that existed for X-ray crystallography and then apply them to images. But it was, the reality was completely, completely different. Because the behavior of images and electron microscopy with very, very strong noise.
What was the problem that this research set out to solve? Just to give everyone sort of an overview of what you really set out to do.
It was really, in the end, I got into so many areas in my PhD thesis. These were all little discoveries that had to do with, you know, what one finds out when one does image processing and Fourier processing of images. And so I got a lot of discoveries and new applications. I for the first time, used correlation functions, two-dimensional correlation, cross-correlation, to align images with one another. I found out a very interesting thing with what happens when an image gets superposed on top of itself, as it happens when you have drift in the electron microscope. So all these things happen, and I made discoveries and wrote programs for the first time. And so I had my thesis is a whole collection of observations, but I never got to the point of 3D reconstruction. But then thinking about it afterwards, these were really all the seeds for the later work were in my thesis already. These tools there.
So it sort of initially started.
A lot of ideas that came from it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So there were lots of little things.
But certainly not the this topic of single particle reconstruction did not come up there in the thesis. It only developed later.
And what was it so that your research set out to solve? So what was the initial, the gap that was there?
Well, the gap was simply something that was pretty obvious, because the first application of electromicroscopy to molecules, they were all working essentially with ideas of X-ray crystallography, meaning that structure is only defined if it's crystal structure. So instead of three-dimensional crystals, these were now two-dimensional crystals, because electrons don't penetrate that much, okay? So there were two-dimensional crystals, or these were crystalline arrangements in a helical form, or you had icosahedral viruses with 60-fold symmetry. So all these were ideas of applying the electron microscopy to crystalline arrangements. And there was a very, 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 very nice big breakthroughs right initially done on that subject. And the first one was by de Rossier and Klug at the MRC. This was the first 3D reconstruction that was ever done for electron microscopic images. And this was of a helical structure of the bacteriophage tail. And so then the obvious question that was on everybody's mind was why crystals? Why should it be crystal? Why can't we look at single molecules? And the advantage would be obvious, because then the field would be wide open, because we wouldn't have to seek methods to produce perfect crystals. And the crystals need to be perfect in order to get high resolution, because you need to be very, very high order. So then my mentor's idea of approaching this was to essentially have molecules dispersed on the EM grid, and then tilt the grid around in increments through as wide an angle as possible, and then reconstruct the whole thing, everything, the support grid as well as the molecules on top. So then you would get multiple 3D reconstructions, each of an individual molecule. But there was an obvious disadvantage of this, which is that you irradiate the molecule multiple times, many, many times. And this produces damage to the molecule. And when the damage becomes so big, then the molecule essentially burns up. And so you get a reconstruction, yes, but it's meaningless. And so that was really the question that was on my mind. And I I thought his approach was really not going to work. And then I thought about how to approach this. And I think the idea that developed later was really was already implied in my thesis, even though it was not spelled out. And the idea was simply that if you had molecules in solution and could somehow put it, prepare it so that we can look at it in the microscope, then you would have multiple structures, so multiple copies of the same structure in random orientations. So if you take a snapshot of that, then you implicit an entire spectrum of views all at the same time. So you don't even have to tilt. Because the molecule tilts itself, and you have multiple structures, and you have as many structures as you want, as many copies as you want, by simply repeating this experiment over and over and over again. You collect as much data as possible in order to fill the angular gaps everywhere. So that was the whole thing. And so the idea was simple, but the execution was difficult because you didn't know the tilt angles. You know, you didn't know anything about it. So you had to then find methods to get the tilt angles after the fact, after the experiment. And this it involved computation. It involved very complicated computations. And then I already had solved, in my thesis, I had already solved the problem of aligning projections with one another by cross-correlation. And so a number of tools were already available. So then, since there were so many problems to solve and so many programs to be developed, I made myself a workbench of programs. So instead of designing a huge, huge program that became bigger and bigger each time I had a new idea, I made many, many small programs that all communicated with one another. So it became a modular image processing system. And many subsequent packages have the same idea of modular image processing. And I got my idea not on my own, but by my visit to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in 1971. That was my first postdoc experience. And I was at the Jet Propulsion Lab, which was at the time, I think, probably the world's best place to do image processing. And they had an image processing system that had a modular design. It was called Vicar. And I looked it up recently. It's still around. It has an elaborate description. And it was designed 2 years before I went, no, three years before I went there. Five years before I went there in 1966.
Wow. And with sort of the end result of your research, what are the implications of that now? So what does that enable people to do? See these structures and
Well, the gap in knowledge is pretty obvious because in structures were solved by X-ray crystallography. Protein structures were solved by X-ray crystallography. Only a very tiny number of structures were solved by electron microscopy of crystalline structures. But the overwhelming amount was of crystalline structures of molecules. And to date, there are over 140,000 structures in the protein data bank, publicly accessible. And these are all from X-ray crystallography. And so the gap is pretty obvious. All the molecules that could not be crystallized at high resolution were unexplored and unexplorable. So my research filled a gigantic gap. Mm-hmm. And that was immediately, what happened was that the resolution of the methods that I developed was initially not that great because the instruments were not perfected, but also there was a very big problem. And the problem was the recording device. The best recording was on film, but the film itself is still not very good as a recording device. And so up to the year 2012, there was progress and lots of groups already did single particle techniques, but the prevailing assumption was that it would never get to atomic resolution, that we would get stuck. And we were stuck at that time at 5 angstrom resolution for the ribosome. and we could not overcome this hurdle. And then in 2012, the recording problem was solved. They were very new cameras came on the market by three different companies, which had superior resolution in the recording of electron images. And they, in fact, they recorded single electrons. So you could get very large reduction in noise, improvement in resolution, and signal to noise ratio. And that brought really the so-called resolution revolution in this whole field that I had started a long time ago. So from a certain point of view, it is an utterly trivial problem, okay? Everything else is solved, but the recording, recording. And that trivial problem was a very big obstacle. And once it was removed, then all of a sudden everything went forward. And the very big, the first step was in 2013, a membrane protein was solved at atomic resolution by Yifan Cheng at UCSF. And this was the TVRP1 channel. Along with it came the problem of mimicking the membrane for the molecule, because we needed single molecules. We needed molecules that really could tumble in all different directions. And so you have to mimic the membrane environment for the protein. That was the biochemical sample preparation problem. But that was solved in many different ways meanwhile, so that among all the new problems that could be solved were the many very interesting channel structures, channels and receptor structures. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are thousands now that have been solved by single particle cryo-EM.
And with this like massive field that you've now sort of initiated, was this research something that you sort of ever had in your mind, oh, I'm working towards a Nobel Prize, or was the Nobel Prize just something that came and you just took it in your stride?
Nobody works toward the Nobel Prize.
Right.
That would be the most most difficult thing and most frustrating thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the chances of getting the Nobel Prize are so small, they're minuscule, and even when you look at the all the people that have been nominated and didn't get the prize, and very often it's sort of it's a matter of luck on top of all the efforts that you have made. So I wouldn't advise anybody to work towards a Nobel Prize.
But since sort of being awarding it, has it changed your sort of attitude to science in any way? Do you sort of feel it's opened doors, or is it sort of like the end of a chapter?
Well, the end of a chapter implies the start of another chapter. So you offer me two options that are the same. You mean the end of the book or a new chapter? Yeah. Well, it's essentially, what happens is that you can relax. You're not in this kind of race, because you always have this idea, well, what if, mm-hmm. It would be great. And but when that kind of ambition is no longer a force, then you can relax and you can make choices on what you want to focus on, or you can maybe pick avenues that are less popular or more risky, and that's what I have done. So I've focused on things that had not been explored before, and where a lot of new thoughts were needed, new creativity, and where I could really motivate students to enter.
So what is next for you? What have you been doing since? What's your plan for the future?
Well, one of them is time resolve techniques. These are techniques, the time resolve cryo electron microscopy, the standard technique implies that you work within you know, a certain delay. You have to put the solution with the molecules onto the EM grid. We have pipette a little droplet there, and then you have to blot the excess liquid away, and then you plunge the grid into the cryogen. Now all that is a multi-step procedure that takes a few seconds at least. And so you cannot, with this approach, you cannot study anything that goes through some kind of an intermediate. You cannot go and look at intermediate reaction products in a time range, let's say, from 10 to 1,000 milliseconds. And so I set out to do that. There was a device that was already developed while I was in Albany before I came to Columbia University in 2008. So the device that was developed in a collaboration between the Wadsworth Center in Albany and RPI in Troy. And this is a microfluidic device that enables you to mix two components very rapidly and then let them react over a certain distance of time. And so there are different microfluidic chips for different reaction times. So then you can, at the end of the channel in which the two mixing components react, there is an outlet with a sprayer, and the reaction products are sprayed onto the EM grid in little droplets. So then you can then look at the, or you can, from then on, you can collect the data as usual. And so you get an entire time series. You get different time points, and for each time points, you get different distribution of subpopulations of all the different states. And among these subpopulations are the ones that you're looking for that have the sort of a finite residence time in an intermediate state.
So that's sort of related to what you were doing before in terms of imaging, but also taking just a completely different avenue away from it. Okay. And so a lot of our listeners are PhD students themselves, and I'm sure they'd really appreciate it if you could give any advice. What would you tell sort of your younger self as a scientist?
Hopefully it has become clear that my whole career was very much marked by accidents. So I didn't really have a very clear idea of what I was going to do. And so one advice is really to look out for things that come your way. When you solve a problem, you get some unexpected answers, and you have to sort of track these answers. Very often you get impulses from the periphery. A peripheral vision is one of the advice that I would say. You know, don't limit yourself to a very narrow area of pursuit. You look out for impulses from the periphery. And the other one is what I learned is that it is very useful to be stubborn. If you have an interesting idea, don't let yourself be talked out of it, even by your mentor. Mentors can be wrong, In my case, I think the mentor was seriously wrong, but I really owe him credit because I I really got steered toward my path by objecting to his very specifically objecting to what he had in mind. Okay, so this was another way of steering. So these are the two things that I would advise people.
I think that's the two very valid points I think a lot of people should probably be doing more of. And now just to finish off, we have one question that we ask all of our guests, and that's just to get to know you a little bit more outside of the research world. And we'd just like to know what your favorite book is. What are you reading right now? What would you recommend?
Oh, I haven't read a lot of books recently because of the overall anxiety, the prevailing anxiety here. you know, we live in total isolation with our daughter and son-in-law and grandchild, and we are very careful with contacts. You know, both because of my age and because of the young baby. And so this is all nerve-wracking. It's really nerve-wracking. Even though we are in a beautiful environment here in the Berkshires, but this is all on our mind. Now, I'm surrounded by so many books, and many of the books are rediscovered when I moved a lot from my Manhattan apartment up here. I have a much larger library, and one book that I just recently picked was The Tenant by The Tenants by Bernard Malamud.
Right,
Bernard Malamud. So I vaguely remembered reading it a long time ago, but since I've been writing more and more myself, I've been doing fiction writing.
Oh, really?
Which answers part of your question now. I have a much different approach to language now, and so I appreciate the writing on so many different levels. And I, you know, as a plug, which you can erase if you want.
No.
I have just published my first novel, which is called Anzee, A-A-N-Z-E-E, Anzee, which is Dutch for by the sea. And so you can look it up. And
what's it about? What's the theme?
Well, it is about a scientist who had a similar upbringing, you know, being originally from Germany, from Europe, and then now living in the States. And then he goes back, and it happened to be the Netherlands. And this becomes sort of a journey into the past for him. And I think it's interesting, it's quirky, and he makes all kinds of discoveries and transforms in the process, I think.
Well, what sort of made you want to start writing novels?
I'm sorry?
What sort of started you on this track to write novels?
Oh, this was actually, you know, I've done a lot of German writing before I came to the States, and I really enjoyed immersing myself in another language. And when I did the first, you know, I wrote my first short stories and started with dialogue and so on. And then I went to some writing classes with professors at the university. I got a lot of very nice feedback, and they encouraged me. And one one was William Kennedy, who is known outside the the States. So one of the short stories has become chapter four of my novel. That short story describes a very strange Byzantine hotel in the Netherlands, where the conference participant lands. So he encouraged me to really make a novel out of it, and I made a novel out of it.
Well, you must like to keep yourself busy.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. I think it's been very interesting. Certainly for me, I've learned a lot, and I think you've been really inspiring the advice that you gave our PhD students as well. So great. Thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, great. Good luck to all of you.